Over 100 years before competitive cyclist Lance Armstrong used performance-enhancing drugs, other professional cyclists were already taking advantage. In particular, cycling coach Choppy Warburton from England encouraged the use of racing drugs, at least as early as 1891, when the 350-mile Bordeaux to Paris cycling race first took place. That was the precursor to the modern Tour de France, the world's most famous multiple-stage bicycling competition, which began in 1903. Competitors were known to use stimulants like caffeine and cocaine, as well as nitroglycerin, which dilates vessels to help deliver more blood to body tissues. Racers even tried strychnine, which, although a known poison, is excitatory to the nervous and muscular systems due to its effects on a particular neurotransmitter. Amphetamines eventually became the more common drugs of choice, especially by the late 1880s, when pharmaceutical labs started synthesizing them. At that point, there really wasn't anything illegal about so-called doping, but it did lead to several deaths, including at least three members of Choppy's cycling teams. At the time of these early races, people more or less accepted, or at least thought, it would be near impossible to compete for such long distances under all kinds of conditions without some kind of chemical assistance. So performance-enhancing drugs didn't become illegal until June of 1965. In July the following year, the Tour de France began drug testing its athletes. America's most well-known cyclist of the recent past is no doubt Lance Armstrong. Born in Texas, Armstrong turned pro in 1992 at age 21, and within the next few years won major competitions, including stages within the Tour de France. In the 1996 Summer Olympics, Armstrong cycled for the U.S., coming in sixth in time trials and 12th in the road race. But Armstrong's athletic career had to be put on hold in October of 1996 when he was diagnosed with stage 3 testicular cancer. Armstrong underwent surgery and successful treatment, despite the cancer already having traveled to his brain, lungs, and abdomen. And incredibly, by the late 90s, he was not only back into competitive cycling, but began a series of 7 consecutive first place wins in the Tour de France between 1999 and 2005. Armstrong announced his retirement from the sport in the summer of 2005, only to make a comeback in 2009, taking third place in that year's Tour de France. In early 2011, Armstrong retired again, but this time under a cloud of shame. After years of denying claims he had used performance-enhancing drugs, in 2012, Armstrong was accused by the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency of being part of, quote, the most sophisticated, professionalized, and successful doping program that sport has ever seen. Let's look at some of the forensic evidence that led up to that charge. Now, while allegations had been bantered around for years, the first highly publicized suspicion involving Armstrong dates back to 1999 when his urine tested positive for corticosteroids during preliminary drug testing for the Tour de France. Although made naturally by our adrenal glands, the subclass of corticosteroids known as glucocorticoids are banned by the World Doping Agency. Glucocorticoids are natural anti-inflammatory hormones that also help us regulate protein and carbohydrate metabolism, as well as electrolyte balance. Glucocorticoid hormones are banned if suspected to be from an exogenous source. In other words, in levels higher than the body itself could normally produce. To explain the positive test result, Armstrong's team doctor produced a prescription for a steroid ointment he said was used to treat a saddle sore Armstrong had developed. Though most of Armstrong's associates didn't fall for this story, the governing body for international cycling races, known as the UCI, did believe the doctor's claim and let Armstrong continue with the race. It's now known through sworn testimony at the anti-doping agency's hearing that the team physician backdated the prescription. Armstrong's personal assistant and massage therapist also stated she never knew anything about a saddle sore ointment, and if that treatment had been ordered, she would have been the one to apply it. In her testimony, this assistant also described having to dispose of used syringes and once having to use her makeup to cover an injection bruise on Armstrong's arm. Another hormone that's been used by athletes is erythropoietin, also known as EPO or simply EPO. Erythropoietin is made by the kidneys to increase red blood cell production in bone marrow. Since red cells deliver oxygen to muscles, the use of EPO ultimately enhances endurance. Now, athletes got away with EPO use for years because there was no blood screen capable of detecting the pharmaceutical versions. That is, until 2000, when the French National Anti-Doping Agency developed a test for synthetic EPO. During the hearings that Armstrong later faced, many of his teammates admitted to using EPO and testified that he did too. Riders were taught by the team doctor to inject it directly into their veins, not under their skin, and to get rid of their syringes and empty soda cans. Teammates also claimed Armstrong helped supply them not only with EPO, but also testosterone, human growth hormone, and other banned substances that he pressured them to use. Armstrong and other team members even engaged in blood transfusions, or rather reinfusions of their own blood that they had previously extracted from each other. They hung blood bags from picture hooks in hotels or in the team van along the roadside while the driver faked engine difficulty. Some cyclists recalled the icy chill of the cold blood as it entered their veins, or dumping drugs into the commode on the team's camper when they thought police were about to raid them. On one occasion, Armstrong suddenly dropped out of a race in Spain. That was because a teammate texted him a heads up that testing officials were waiting at his hotel. There were so many near misses when Armstrong wasn't caught. Like the time a team physician diluted the cyclist's tainted blood using an IV bag of saline the doctor smuggled under his coat and into Armstrong's bedroom, walking right past the drug inspector setting up his blood testing station in the apartment living room. Eventually, the forensic evidence used by the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency in the summer of 2012 included lab reports from blood samples taken during Armstrong's 2009 to 2010 comeback, as well as emails, photographs, and financial documents, including forensic accounting records detailing payments of over $1 million to one of the team's physicians. The agency ultimately amassed more than 1,000 pages of testimony from 26 different witnesses, including 11 of Armstrong's cycling teammates who decided to break their code of silence and come forward. Armstrong was not only indicted by the agency for using banned substances, but also drug possession and trafficking, among other offenses. They also brought charges against the team's director, trainer, and three doctors. The U.S. Anti-Doping Agency issued what they called a reasoned decision in the matter and submitted it to the UCI, International Cycling Organization. By the fall of 2012, Armstrong was stripped of all medals he had accumulated between the years 1998 and 2010, which included all of his Tour de France victories. He was permanently banned from participation in any future professional competitions. Law enforcement authorities didn't file criminal charges, though, probably because, in the words of the United States Anti-Doping Agency, the UCI didn't have any official record of Armstrong failing drug tests. Their position was that this also implicated the UCI for aiding in what the agency believed was a long-standing cover-up. In other words, that Armstrong should have been caught long ago, and probably was, but his blood doping went ignored by nearly all of cycling, especially the International Union. Armstrong refused to respond or even request a hearing to challenge the charges. Eventually, though, in early 2013, during an interview with Oprah Winfrey, Lance Armstrong finally admitted to the world that he had been involved in the use of performance-enhancing drugs. However, the cyclist alleges he stopped doping in 2005 at the time of his first retirement, and that his comeback wins in and after 2009 were unaided by banned substances. I don't think many people believe that. Some have even wondered whether taking substances like human growth hormone either caused or accelerated his cancer, since cancer is a form of uncontrolled cell growth. but clinicians haven't demonstrated any type of link at this point. As we know, the use of banned substances is not particular to cycling. After years of denial, 7-time Mr. Olympia, world champion bodybuilder Arnold Schwarzenegger, admitted to using anabolic steroids, saying, "You do whatever it takes to get to the top." After all, they were still legal at the time. He did them under a doctor's care, and Schwarzenegger says he doesn't regret it. Doping has undoubtedly touched virtually all professional sports. Athletes have probably looked for magic potions to increase speed, strength, and endurance for as long as competitions have been held. Baseball's mighty Babe Ruth is even said to have administered himself an injection of sheep testicle extract, later saying it didn't work as a muscle enhancer and only made him sick to his stomach. By the 60s and 70s, both amphetamines and steroids became widely used in baseball and were available in any clubhouse, according to many pro players. Hall of Fame third baseman Mike Schmidt has stated that, quote, "Amphetamine use in baseball is both far more common and has been going on a lot longer than steroid abuse." But comparing college or rookie photos of some players to their beefed-up appearance in professional days sure seems to suggest muscle enhancement that just working out can't provide. In 1998, baseball fans were caught up in the race for the most home runs in a single season between Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa, who were both on track to surpass the record of Roger Maris's 61 home runs hit in 1961. By the end of the season, McGwire hit 70 and Sosa 66. 7 years later, in 2005, both record breakers, as well as many other big-name stars, were called to testify before Congress on the use of performance-enhancing drugs in baseball. That was the same year that outfielder and power hitter Jose Canseco admitted to drug use in his book titled Juiced, Wild Times, Rampant Roids, Smash Hits, and How Baseball Got Big. Canseco's claims that the vast majority of other Major League Baseball players also used steroids made him plenty of enemies, but he says he doesn't regret coming forward. In 2006, Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig asked Congress to institute an investigation into the use of steroids and human growth hormones in his sport. Some thought Congress was overstepping its authority and wasting taxpayer money on an agency that should be policing itself, calling it a photo op for congressmen. The investigation interviewed current and former players, most of whom denied any use of banned substances, as well as interviewing coaches, trainers, and even a former bat boy, who proved to be a key witness by providing names in exchange for a plea bargain. He had been accused of distributing a controlled substance and money laundering and faced a 30-year sentence. The final report, released almost 2 years later, named 89 current and former players. The report also made suggestions to help eliminate the use of drugs in the sport. As a result, baseball enhanced its drug testing policies and penalties for users became more severe. Now, it's bad enough for an athlete to enhance his or her own performance, but another thing entirely to get ahead by sabotaging a fellow competitor. In that regard, two promising U.S. female figure skaters started with a lot in common, but ended up as enemies. Nancy Kerrigan was born in Massachusetts in 1969, and Tanya Harding the following year in Oregon. Nancy learned to skate playing hockey with her older brothers. Tanya is said to have skated at a nearby shopping mall rink as an escape from a difficult family life. Her mother was said to be abusive, and Tanya was the daughter of mom's fifth husband. Neither girl came from money, even though figure skating is an expensive sport. But before they had reached teenage years, the girls' trainers had noticed clear natural talent. Tanya was a strong athletic performer, and Nancy was tall, elegant, and graceful. Both began entering and winning competitions, and each earned a spot at the 1992 Winter Olympics, where Nancy won the third-place bronze medal and Tanya came in fourth. In January of 1994, the U.S. Figure Skating Championships were scheduled for Detroit. The day before the competition began, as Kerrigan was leaving the practice ice to head to her dressing room, A man rushed up behind her and smacked her just above the right knee with some type of club, knocking her to the ground. The suspect then ran off, and witnesses reported he got into a waiting car and sped away. The next day, Harding won first place, while Kerrigan nursed a painful and bruised right thigh. By the time of the attack, a man named Sean Eckert had already confessed to his minister friend that he was part of a conspiracy to attack Kerrigan. Eckert was Tanya Harding's personal bodyguard, as well as the lifelong friend of her ex-husband, Jeff Galluli. At the time of the confession, the minister was a college classmate of Eckert in a paralegal program, and he ended up reporting the incident to two of their professors, an ethics professor who was also an attorney, and another professor who was a private detective. The friend told the professors that Eckert, Harding's bodyguard, had played him an audio tape of the four conspirators discussing their plan. Eckert told his friend he had made the tape in case he ended up needing to blackmail the other three guys. The friend said Eckert even thought a side benefit of the Kerrigan attack would be that other skaters would want protection, and the bodyguard could then expand his business by hiring and managing friends to watch over frightened skaters. Now, this attorney-slash-professor agreed to represent Eckert in any subsequent legal actions against him if Eckert's friend would take the allegation to the FBI. After the man agreed, the FBI asked Eckert's friend to wear a wire and meet Eckert at a local restaurant to try to get him to talk. Now, agents told Eckert's friend, do not get in the car with the bodyguard because they couldn't protect him there, and they knew Eckert carried a loaded gun. But as soon as Eckert got to the restaurant, he asked his friend to take a ride. When the man refused Eckert's invitation, the FBI got nothing. They'd have to pick up the bodyguard for questioning. But when they did, Eckert confessed, claiming it was Galluli's idea to get Nancy Kerrigan out of the picture so Harding would have a better chance at the U.S. Championships in January, which would then, in turn, take her to the Olympics in Norway the following month. Eckert, as Harding's bodyguard, and Galluli, who was back living with her despite their divorce, were both too closely associated with Harding, so they had to come up with somebody else to assault Kerrigan. Eckert had asked his friend Derek Smith, who refused, but Smith instead offered the plan to his nephew, Shane Stant from Phoenix. Stant was originally asked to slit Kerrigan's Achilles tendon, but he refused to cut her. Instead, he agreed to damage her right knee, her landing leg, for $6,500. The conspirators were initially planning to attack Kerrigan at her home rink in Massachusetts, but couldn't figure out her exact practice schedule. The FBI later used phone records to verify that four phone calls were placed from the Galluli Harding home in Portland, Oregon, to Kerrigan's practice rink. But by the time Stant finally got to the Massachusetts location, Kerrigan was already on her way to the figure skating championship, so the plan had to shift to an attack at the competition arena in Detroit. Stant and his uncle, Derek Smith, cased the arena in the days before the assault. The weapon Stant used was a collapsible police baton. And after hitting Kerrigan, Stant tried to run to the exit door he had scoped out the day before, but now it was chained shut. He literally rammed through the plexiglass panel to make his escape, threw the baton underneath the car in the parking lot, and jumped into his uncle's car to make a getaway. Nobody really got a good look at Stant, since all eyes and cameras were on Nancy. The video of her on the ground immediately following the injury was broadcast all over the world by the next day. After winning the championship, Harding, along with Galluli, Eckert, and Smith, returned to Portland, Oregon. But 1 week after the attack, Eckert and getaway driver Derek Smith were arrested and charged with conspiracy to commit assault. That was based on the confession Sean Eckert had made to his minister friend. FBI agents arrested Shane Stant the next morning in Phoenix. Rumors swirled that Galluli and Harding were also connected to the case and would probably be arrested. They both denied involvement but hired attorneys. During the FBI interviews, Harding changed her story, saying she didn't know about the plot until she came home to Portland. She admitted to not coming forward earlier, but claimed she was only keeping quiet to protect Galluli and the others. But one piece of evidence ended up solidly implicating Harding in the plot. Now, this was found in a dumpster outside a Portland area bar. Strangely enough, the bar's owner routinely punished people who put their trash in the dumpster she paid for. She did this by opening the bags, figuring out who had capitalized on her trash pickup, and then returning the garbage to them. In late January of 1994, when the bar owner found unwanted bags of trash in her dumpster and opened them, she found paperwork belonging to Jeff Galluli, whose name was already heavily in the news. Rather than calling Harding's ex-husband to get his trash, she instead phoned the FBI. Among the items in the bag was a check stub from the U.S. Figure Skating Association and handwriting that forensic investigators later determined belonged to Tanya Harding. What she had written was the name and phone number of Nancy Kerrigan's practice rink in Massachusetts, linking Harding to the scheme. In February of 1994, Jeff Galluli pleaded guilty to racketeering. After a plea agreement to testify against Harding, he ended up getting 2 years in prison and a $100,000 fine. The other three conspirators were indicted and all received jail sentences. Sean Eckert pled guilty to racketeering. Derek Smith and Shane Stant pled guilty to conspiracy to commit second-degree assault. Despite not skating in the U.S. Championships due to her injury, Nancy Kerrigan was selected for the 1994 Winter Olympics in Norway. During the same month, Galluli pled guilty to his involvement in the attack. At that point, the extent of Tanya Harding's participation wasn't known, so she was also given the green light to skate for the U.S. in Norway. And during her Olympic performance, Harding fell apart. She had trouble with her skates, and she delivered a very poor showing, after which she finished eighth. But Nancy was near perfect on the ice and won the silver medal. In the month following the Olympics, Harding pled guilty to conspiracy to hinder prosecution. That was just days before she was to leave for the World Championships in Japan. So when the judge sentenced Harding to 3 years probation, 500 hours community service, and a fine of $160,000, she was forced to resign from the U.S. Figure Skating Association and never made it to Japan. Now, 20 years later, Harding still alleges she had no prior knowledge of the plan to sabotage Kerrigan. Kerrigan has said she's tried to believe that for a long time. Harding's career was ruined. And if things weren't bad enough, Harding's ex-husband, Jeff Galluli, released videotape to the tabloids of he and a very drunk Tanya Harding having sex. She's had no product endorsements and limited opportunities. Harding's exploits have amounted to nothing much more famous than winning a celebrity boxing match against Paula Jones, the woman who tried to sue President Bill Clinton for sexual harassment, which opened up the door to the whole Monica Lewinsky sex scandal. Now, let's finish this lecture by returning to two baseball scandals connected to my hometown favorites, the Cincinnati Reds. Breaking with tradition, the 1919 World Series was, like a few other years, a best-of-nine series, rather than the usual best-of-seven. It was to be a contest between the Reds and the Chicago White Sox. But the Sox first baseman, Arnold Chick Gandel, apparently convinced seven of his teammates to deliberately lose the series. Their incentive was payment promised from organized crime members who would bet against them. Gandel apparently wanted to get back at White Sox owner Charlie Comiskey, who had a reputation for paying really low salaries. And the players were really in a difficult place at that time because American pro baseball had a rule that if a man refused the salary offered, he couldn't play for another major league team. The bad guys got a lucky break in the scam when one of the leading Sox pitchers, Red Faber, a guy who would not have allowed the scandal, got the flu and was benched. So Eddie Chakotay pitched the first game of the series for the White Sox and lost. Then Claude Lefty Williams pitched them another loser. When the series moved from Cincinnati to Chicago for Game 3, White Sox pitcher Dickey Kerr, who wasn't in on the scam, won for his team. But Chakotay threw the fourth game, losing for Chicago, after which four of the dirty players got a payment of $20,000 to split, leaving Williams more than happy to lose the Sox's fifth game. The teams then moved back to Cincinnati, where the Sox coaches put Dickie Kerr back in for the sixth game, and he won. By then, rumors of the fix were swirling. Chakotay may have had second thoughts or was mad about the money he was owed because he won Game 7. At this point, the Sox had lost four games but won three. On the night before the eighth game, Williams was visited in Chicago by some of the mobsters who threatened to kill him and his wife, so he lost the series for the Sox. During the following season, the rumors continued, and in September of 1920, Eddie Chakotay and outfielder Shoeless Joe Jackson confessed to a grand jury. Despite being in the race for the American League pennant at the time, all seven of the bad guys still on the team were suspended. Ringleader Chick Gandel had already been sent down to the minor leagues. Some sources have doubted whether Shoeless Joe Jackson really was involved, saying he was naive, illiterate, and had played quite well during the 1919 World Series. But in October of 1920, the grand jury handed down indictments, naming eight Chicago players. Shortly after the defendants were arraigned, though, the confessions were signed by Chakotay and Jackson went missing. So that evidence wasn't available at trial in the summer of 1921. Despite eyewitness testimony from teammates, without those confessions, all eight players were acquitted. Still, the commissioner of baseball banned all of them from the game for life. The infamous incident is now popularly called the Black Sox scandal, but some say the team was already called the Black Sox before the series even started. That's because their tightwad owner, Comiskey, rarely had the team's uniforms washed, saying if players wanted them clean, they should do it themselves. Comiskey did get the uniforms laundered for the 1919 series, but deducted the cost from the players' salaries. Oh, and years later, the missing confessions were found in the possession of Comiskey's attorney. Now, let's finish with Cincinnati's Mr. Baseball. Born and raised in what's now a poor, rundown Westside Cincinnati neighborhood, just miles from where I grew up, Pete Rose eventually became baseball's all-time hit king. He was named Rookie of the Year in 1963 during his first season for the Cincinnati Reds and went on to 17 All-Star games. Rose's speed earned him the nickname Charlie Hustle. Plus, he was a switch hitter who played five different positions during his career. Now, don't tell anybody, but I remember occasionally skipping school with my girlfriends to take the bus down to the stadium. And man, could that guy play. Rose's first 15 professional years were spent in Cincinnati, until 1979, when the Philadelphia Phillies offered him a four-year, $3.2 million contract, at that time the highest salary in baseball. Following that, Rose played a year for the Montreal Expos before coming back to his hometown in 1984. In Cincinnati, Rose finished his career as a player/manager for 2 years and then managed full-time until 1989. Now, back in Cincinnati, Pete was known to have problems with gambling. He was often seen at the horse tracks, but suspicions also emerged that he had been betting on baseball. In early 1989, the baseball commissioner appointed a lawyer to investigate. By spring, a 225-page report was compiled showing evidence of Pete Rose betting on a total of 52 games. A guy I actually knew, named Tommy Giosa, was the bouncer at a popular downtown nightclub and manager of a Cincinnati gym. He and another guy named Paul Jansen were friends of Rose's. The lawyer's investigative report detailed that Tommy and Paul had placed bets for Pete in 1985 and 1986 to the tune of up to $10,000 per game. There was clear forensic evidence in the form of canceled checks. Two of Rose's bookies stated Pete's bets may have surpassed $1 million during those 2 years. Although the report showed no evidence that Rose bet against the Reds or tried to do anything to throw a game, betting on baseball is strictly forbidden by anybody professionally associated with a team. In the summer of 1989, Rose agreed to voluntarily take a lifetime ban from the sport he loved and a settlement with Major League Baseball. Rose's compromise had three provisions. First, Major League Baseball would stop its investigation and make no finding of fact. Second, Rose was neither admitting nor denying the charges. And third, he could apply for reinstatement after 1 year. 8 days later, baseball commissioner Bart Giamatti died of a heart attack. In 2004, just before the release of his autobiography, My Prison Without Bars, Rose finally admitted to betting on baseball on ABC's Good Morning America. Pete has said he picked the wrong vice, claiming, quote, "I would have been better off taking drugs or beating my wife," end quote, because he'd probably have gotten a second chance. Rose has applied for reinstatement twice and been refused. In Cincinnati, we all wonder if he'll ever reach his dream of being inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame.